Good afternoon. It's Thursday, June 6th at 5:30. We're in the Veterans Memorial Building, and this is the regular June meeting of the City of Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board. I am Mark Blackford, who's acting as the chairman this week, and Ron Reisner is now present. We have a quorum, and so therefore I'd like to call the meeting to order. I'd like to start with a moment of silence, and in thinking of our moment of silence, since this is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Thank you. The pledge. Cherise, would you care to lead?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, Chairman, Advisory Board Member, and Liaison Announcements and Presentations. Cherise, anything new?
No, not this time.
Lynn?
Nope.
Announcements?
No. I'm sorry. Not saying anything from the salmon issues. We got salmon here. Is this the time?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Just lost my head for a minute. Fortunately, there's a very good issue to report with our salmon fishing on the Central Coast has been fantastic this year. And, you know, it's been a very, very good year. But that isn't to say that, you know, this is like the most spectacular thing in the world. We're very happy to have it. It's a great season. Probably the best we've seen in 18 years or so. There's a lot of boats from Oregon and Northern California down here, which, you know, is a really good thing because we share their waters. Most of our guys share their waters all year long. It's always nice to have them down here. We can reciprocate. So we've got a lot of out-of-town boats here, and I don't have any numbers, but there's been a lot of salmon. So we do have the dredge. I'm sure that Eric will be expounding on that a little more, but the dredge, I think, was announced the last meeting also, but the dredge is in town, and we're getting the entrance dredge. Well, I'm always very happy about that. I probably won't be back until November meeting, I hope, somewhere in that zone, that we will have one of our other alternates sitting here for that time. So I'll be going albacore fishing in Washington, Oregon, northern Pacific.
Well, I want to echo what Jim about the salmon boats. They're just gorgeous boats coming in. Seeing the young families on new boats or old boats, and there's just some classic looking boats, and it's just wonderful to see these guys out there working and seeing all the activity on the waterfront.
All right. I don't believe we have a board liaison here today to give us announcements. Huh? I'm sorry. Any announcements from the...
Hi, my name is Robert Davis. I'm sitting in this evening for Marlis because she's out of town. She did not tell me that I was expected to make announcements, so I don't have any announcements.
Terrific. All right. We will have one change to the agenda today. We're looking to move item B5 to the top of our agenda as B1, following our report, as we will have some individuals here that may not want to sit through some of the more tedious details of our meeting. Is any objection from the board on that? Okay. This is our public comment period. We had somebody that was there. Now they're gone.
That's Ella Weinstein from Castle Wind. She's your B5 item.
There might be B5 item. Okay.
Might take her a minute to load up a presentation.
Seeing no audience members present currently to comment, we will move on from the public comment period. Consent calendar. Status report. Harbor Department status report.
Does anybody want to pull it? So last meeting, were you here last meeting?
Yeah.
You were here last. So we put it on consent, meaning it just gets approved along with the minutes.
Okay.
Unless there's some changes to be made, unless somebody has any questions on the item, then they can pull it, and then we can discuss it, and then approve it.
Which any questions with regard to the report? All those in favor of including those in the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Then moving on. Our first item is the update of the status of the offshore wind energy generation development on the Central Coast, California coast, and question and answer session with offshore wind farm proponent Castle Wind LLC. Certainly.
Did you do field grass stuff?
Hi, Robert Davis. If I could take a excuse me, a second shot while Ola is warming up. I would like to report that the council last week identified harbor infrastructure needs as a major capital need for the future as part of our economic development program. Council asked staff to bring back proposals for increasing revenue for the city for a number of purposes, but one of the major purposes is to get caught up with a lot of overdue harbor infrastructure maintenance and upgrades. So, thank you.
Thank you.
And Mark, if I can indulge you,
Sure.
I'll start off into the staff report a little bit on Castle Wind, and as Ola gets ready, just for the audience and anybody out there in TV land as well. So Castle Wind proposed several years ago to put in a wind farm offshore about 30 miles off of outside of Morro Bay, about 20 miles off the Cambria coast, up off kind of at the bottom end of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. They proposed that to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is BOEM. BOEM then has to legally put it out to bid, which they did, and they have several people expressing interest. BOEM had been intending to move forward through the leasing process this year, but the Department of Defense has raised some concerns about a wind farm with several big, you know, potentially many big wind machines in their training and testing grounds. And so we and Castle and others have been working with our legislators and others to try and alleviate the Department of Defense's concerns and get their concerns addressed and figure out a way to make DOD happy so that they won't object to wind farms being placed off the coast. So that's one of the big items that's been going on most recently with Castle and the city. And when we went back to D.C. in March, we spent a good amount of time with DOD and others addressing that issue. Back in October, we executed a community benefits agreement with Castle. It was in November we executed a community benefits agreement with Castle Wind that, which is included with your staff report, that established a joint cooperative effort between Castle and the City of Morro Bay because we like their approach and what they're doing and how they've come to the city and have basically said, we want to build a wind farm offshore. What are the issues? We want to alleviate them and address them. And one of our biggest concerns was the impacts of the commercial fishing industry because these wind farm would basically represent a large marine protected area because it would probably pretty severely restrict fishing. So Castle went to the Fishermen's Organization, signed an agreement with them, a benefits agreement with them that they executed last October. that addresses the fishermen's concerns. So City of Morro Bay continues to move forward and work with Castle. We just met key staff and key folks from Castle met today and got an update from them. So we're continuing to move forward, and hopefully we can get these DOD issues resolved and Castle can move on forward, and Bureau of Ocean Energy Management can start the leasing process. It'll probably take, between leasing and permitting, several years. Obviously, there's environmental and other issues that need to be addressed, the environmental impact report. All that stuff will take place through the BOEM process. It's just a matter of getting to there, so that's what we've been working on most recently. Also, in your staff report is a sample letter we sent. Like I said, we've been pretty active on the political front, speaking to our legislators and both state level, local level, national level. We've sent letters under the mayor's signature to Congressman Carbajal, our two senators, Speaker Pelosi. The letter to Speaker Pelosi is in your staff packet. Basically, an example of our position on the DOD issues and how we believe they should be resolved. So that's kind of an update. And then I'll have her presentation here and can probably give you a lot more and better details than I ever will be able to.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me to give you an update on the offshore wind project. I'm on the line to do you want me to go there? Okay.
Yeah, you've got a button you can move that forward with.
I'll have to keep looking sideways. Okay.
Good evening. I'm Ala Weinstein, CEO of Castle Wind, and I'm happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me to give you an update on offshore wind project and where things stand with a lot of agencies, actually, but primarily with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and Department of Defense. So I thought we'll start with question number one that a lot of people have been asking me, what's in the logo? And how did the castle name came about? Well, as you'll see, the logo actually explains itself. Trident Winds was the original company that initiated development and suggested the offshore wind development. In March of last year, we formed a joint venture with the EnBW, which is one of the largest utilities in Germany. And the offshore wind is headquartered in Hamburg. Well, the logo of the city of Hamburg is the castle. That is the logo that Hamburg has. And so what we did, I don't know how to find this thing over here. Well, I don't know. There we go. So this is the logo of the city of Hamburg, and we just put the Trident Wind on top of it. So that's how the logo came about, and that's why the name is. It's a castle because it's Hamburg Castle. So what I thought we'll talk about today is why offshore wind in California, what does it do to the state, what is the BOEM process, and where is the status we are, DOD issue, and then infrastructure needs, because that really directly relates to harbors, and not just the harbor of Morro Bay, but all the harbors in California. And then feel free to ask any questions you may have. So why offshore wind in California? As you know, the California passed SB 100 bill at the end of last year, and the bill basically calls for 60% renewable generation and the other 40% from greenhouse gas emissions. Most of the gas emissions are happening in the later part of the day when solar, which is now becoming more and more prominent in California, goes away, and now you're going to rely on your people coming back home, turning on air conditioning, and peaker plants. So-called people, they are gas-fired power plants that are kept running through the day, they become generating the energy. Because by the time we come to the end of the day, when the solar goes away, California Energy, or CAISO, which is California Independent System Operator, has to put back online 13 to 15 gigawatts of energy in a matter of 3 hours. And that's a huge amount of energy that has to go on. Just to give you an idea, the Morro Bay Power Plant generated 1 gigawatt. So that's 13 that type of energy plants have to jump online to replace the energy that went away because solar is gone. So when we look at what does it mean in terms of numbers, the chart on the left represents that if California is to meet its SB 100 requirements, by 2040, it will need to add 20 to 25 gigawatts of solar plus battery. That's an incredible amount. And if you put offshore wind, then the amount of these gigawatts that California has to add in terms of solar and batteries goes down by about the factor of two. But that also means that California will need to add, somewhere there is, there we go, this part which is offshore wind, which is anywhere between 8 to 10 gigawatts. Now, that's still a large number. However, if you think about batteries and their recycling and their disposal and whatever, something that people are not yet talking about, it's environmentally very unfriendly. And in fact, we're not even sure how to do it today. So even though batteries are required, if you rely on solar significantly, it will meet the greenhouse gas emission requirements. But if you start looking at the rest of the environmental impact, it's a question, you know, that at some point somebody will need to answer. So if I look at the second chart, and if I look at the profiles, here's my solar that becomes a lot during the middle of the day. And that is when my this chart is the price of energy on the market. This is what depresses the prices of energy as well, because there is just so much energy available. But when you look at the morning and the evening, the price of energy goes up because the solar is gone. And this line, blue line, is the offshore wind. You can see that out of all sources, solar, onshore wind, or onshore wind from neighboring state, offshore wind is the highest value resource because it's so consistent and because it actually matches the profile of the demand. So that's why California needs to do it. Castle Wind commissioned the study to a company called D3 that does integrated resource planning for the California Public Utilities Commission. And the company did the analysis kind of saying, if we take this model that we use and now we plug in solar, I'm sorry, offshore wind, what is it going to tell us? And that's what the model basically tells you, that California can benefit from 8 to 10 gigawatts of offshore wind at the net savings to the ratepayers of almost $1 billion. And that's significant numbers. That's why offshore wind should be done in California. However, we have major issues, and that's what we're going to talk about in a minute. So our original plan back in 2016 was to bring power from offshore and then reuse the onshore infrastructure that's available here through the outflow tunnel and then use the tunnel to connect to the substation. Since then, we did a lot of work, and one thing we realized that even though we can connect at the substation, but post-substation, like if you go to the first interconnection point, most of that capacity in the transmission lines is taken out by solar farms, by solar installations. So in order for us to bring the energy, we can bring it to shore, but put it in the grid will require significant investments, which is fine because that's a part of project development. We just need to know how much it will be and when it will be. So because the amount of money that would be required is significant, and because there is still uncertainty when the lease auction is going to take place, whether DOD will or will not allow offshore wind development, we applied into the queue position a year ago, but we chose to withdraw our application this year until some of these major uncertainties would go away. So though we were there, we're not longer there, and we will probably apply in a year from now, assuming the auction will take place around 2020, which is what the projections are right now. So this was our original application, and that's the site that we defined by working jointly with a Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen Organization, trying to minimize I can't say that we're going to eliminate the impacts. The impacts will be there, but we try to minimize the impacts and try to go into the area that could provide the minimum impacts. Since then, and after BOEM has determined that there is a competitive interest in September of 2016, they formed the Intergovernmental Task Force. The task force met a few times, developed so-called the data basin that put all the environmental data and constraints together. And they identified these two sites in Central California, what they call the Morro Bay site and the Diablo Canyon site. There is also a third site identified in Northern California called Humboldt Bay site. I think that's what it's called. And so there are three sites that they put out for commenting at the end of last year. It was actually October 19th when the call for nomination was issued. So here is the Bowen process. They go through planning, leasing, then site assessment, construction, operation. So where we are right now is right here. The Intergovernmental Task Force was formed. They met. They defined the areas. They issued the call. The call closed at the end of January of this year. And once the call has closed, then BOEM does the assessment. And after all the comments are received and they assess them, then they're going to issue what's known as area identification and final areas that they're going to potentially put out for sale. One of those inputs that they need is from the Department of Defense. That input has not yet been officially provided. Unofficially, from what we know, Department of Defense continues to say no offshore wind development should take place anywhere in their territory, which would mean that anything in Central California will be not possible to develop. The only place you can do Northern California. However, Northern California doesn't have transmission lines. And so if California is to benefit from this 8 to 10 gigawatts of offshore wind, it needs to look at how these conflicting uses of space can be resolved. So we've been working with the Department of Defense for quite a while. And just to give you an idea of how much interest is now in offshore wind in California compared to 2016, when only one company expressed an interest in our unsolicited lease request, now we have 14 nominations, or nominations from 14 companies, and there are at least two others that did not submit nomination, but we know they're interested. So it's probably more like 16 companies from various places on the planet that are interested in developing offshore wind in California. Two of those companies are, at least two, yeah, oil companies. They are quite big. One of them is Equinor. That's the original company that expressed an interest when we submitted unsolicited lease requests. The second one is Shell. Both of those companies already have leases on the East Coast, and as a result of their participation, or as a result of multiple companies participating, and there in particular, the price for the lease goes up significantly, which is what we see happening on the East Coast. It is conceivable that the same thing will happen on the West Coast as well, particularly here, once we clear out the DOD issues. Why? Because people realize that the demand is there. Theoretically, if you go to both of these sites, and assuming that both can be developed, then you would have about 7 gigawatts right here. However, the Diablo Canyon area is probably not going to be possible to develop because of military operations that take place there, and I think it's almost everybody accepted the fact that Diablo Canyon will not happen. And that means that all the eyes are now going to be looking at the Morro Bay area as a coal area. So we start looking at the Morro Bay area and say, what is possible in the Morro Bay? How many gigawatts can you install? So what we did is we did the analysis. So this area outlined in black is the total theoretical potential or technical potential. It takes into account wind resource, water depth, and grid connection. And so if you look at it, it's a total of about 600 square miles. However, 121 of them, 125 square miles is in the sanctuary, and BOEM, by the federal regulation, is not allowed to, or it's not authorized, to lease outer continental shelf in the sanctuary. So if you take that out, you're left with about 425 square miles in this crosshatched area right here. Part of it goes pretty far north, which was not in the final call areas. It's an area that was identified originally called Morro Bay North Wind Energy Area, but it did not was not included in the call area. But if you do include here, so this whole area is 625 square miles. And that's enough for about 3 gigawatts, and that's it. You can't do any more, even if you wanted to, because the physical constraints prevent you from doing it. We will have to see where we're going to end up. What's happening right now is Department of Defense is analyzing this whole area, and they will have to come back with some resolution. About a month ago or so, there was a meeting that was called by Representative Carbajal, and I believe Jeremiah was in attendance in that meeting, where Department of Defense presented their case. They didn't really do a very good job justifying their position. And so we have assisted Representative Carbajal questioning Department of Defense justification for what they're doing and why they're doing. And so it is conceivable that there will be a next meeting sometime in August, probably beginning of August, where Assistant Secretary of Defense and Representative Carbajal will have another get together to say, okay, so how can this blanket red area can be actually allowed to be developed in certain areas. And the only certain area that you may be looking at is going to be right here. So we'll have to see what they come back with. Right now, we don't know what it's going to be. So that's where the Department of Defense is. Great. Before I go further, do you have any questions? Or should I continue?
Yes, in the area that you're proposing, how deep is the water there?
The water goes
somewhere around
in the sanctuary, it goes from 600 to 800 meter water depth. From here on out is 800 to 1100 meters.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Please continue.
Okay. So even though we can identify the area, and let's hope it will be cleared out by the Department of Defense, and like I'm saying, you know, the best opportunity is going to be in the Morro Bay coal area, we have major issues with fabrication because you need fairly significant amount of space and what deep water depth to be able to fabricate these devices that are all going to be floating. So looking at some of the pictures, this is Bremerhaven. A city on the north of Germany that kind of repurposed itself from a port that was almost dying out to become a hub for offshore wind development in the North Sea. And so this is the type of infrastructure that you literally need to be able to fabricate, stage, and deploy offshore wind. Today, in the state of California, we have nothing like that. Matt McDonald did a study, which was funded by BOEM, to assess all the ports on the west coast of the United States, and their findings were that we don't have a lot. And whatever we have will need to be repurposed, redeveloped with a significant amount of infrastructure money. The only way it can be done such that California can benefit not only from the offshore wind itself, but also from all the jobs that could come, especially during construction period, will require infrastructure investments. And offshore development companies would do that, but everybody will need a pipeline. No original equipment manufacturer like turbine manufacturers will establish fabrication facilities in a location unless they see this pipeline. And a pipeline that they will be looking for is about 1 to 2 gigawatts per year. That will justify the investment. So is the money there? Yes, the money is there. People will invest. Things could happen, but it requires pipeline. And so all of it kind of wraps into this overall question, whether there is a demand, and if there is a demand, is there going to be space to satisfy the demand? And if there is space, then we create the supply chain, and we can realize all the benefits that will come with it. For today, we're only starting on the first kind of step number one. Can we do the first installation and how big that first installation is going to be? And we will probably have to be importing things just because we don't have the infrastructure. But as a minimum, the operation and maintenance could take place locally. And so next week, one of our two engineers and O&M manager are going to be here in Morro Bay looking at the capabilities around Morro Bay, Port St. Louis. We can't really go to the Diablo Canyon because it's not really the area that could be even considered at this point. And I'm talking about the cove, you know, physical infrastructure on shore, not outside for the installation of offshore wind. But we're looking. We're really looking what it will take us to do fabrication, installation, operation, and maintenance. So here is all the challenges that we'll be facing, and they are literally identified by each of the areas. It's the offshore conditions, navigational restriction like bridges, even though we may have a shipyard, but there is a bridge and we can't finish or fabricate the whole unit so that we can tow it out and install. We have capable ports, but they are doing something else. You know, Port Vanimi, like, for example, been looked at quite a lot, but they're doing imports of cars and bananas, and also Navy has a majority of land there. So you say, yeah, maybe I can reuse this, but I have to, again, negotiate conflicting uses of space. So these are all the things that we're going to be looking at once we know what we can install and how much we can install and who will be doing the work. So that's my presentation. If you have any other questions, I would love to answer them. Thank you for your attention.
I didn't have a question. I just want to say thank you very much, Alan, for another presentation. As I said, and was present at many of them, and very good. We certainly want to thank you very much. And Castle and Trident Wind, I just wanted to make sure everybody understood that none of the other corporations approached either the city or the fishermen's organization outside of cursory approaches, pretty much just to let everybody know that they were here, and no other contact, that you were... you remained in contact and met with everybody and kept everybody aware of what was going on. Nobody else has done that, so it's very important that everyone knows. And thank you again.
Thank you.
Again, thank you for your presentation. I have been to a couple of others that you've had in town, and we do appreciate all this contact, to repeat what Jeremiah said. But my question is, should the wind farm be built, will that entire area be off limits to all boats moving through it, or?
No, the area would be off limits to netting and trolling, but the boats can move through them. The units are spaced quite far apart. It's about a mile in between in each row and a mile and a half. No, actually, it's about a half a mile between each unit within the row, and then each row is spaced about a mile. And there is no restrictions for surface traffic. There is also no restriction for surface fishing, just for the pole. You just cannot troll on that because there's too many wires and too many mooring lines underneath.
Okay. And what about whales?
Well, it's an interesting question. Whales, though they look big, when you put them in perspective to 1,000-meter water depth, they're actually pretty small. So the cables and mooring lines, they're pretty large. So far, no biologist, or we are not aware of any whale collision with the mooring lines of something like an oil platform, because the size of the unit, so the size of the mooring, is about the same as the oil and gas platform use. So as far as we know, there shouldn't be any problems. And for somebody like dolphins that have a sonar capability, they can detect these structures. They're big enough for them to be detected. It's not like a crab pot, you know, fish lines that are hard for them to detect. And so we're not aware of any entanglement of whales or dolphins or any other marine mammals in mooring lines of this type.
And that's for all wind farms throughout the world?
Well, we're talking about floating offshore wind, right?
Right,
because
right.
of the water
all
depth.
All of the same kind.
Well, there is not enough wind farm capacity installed yet. By the end of 2021, we'll have about 150 megawatts, which would be about, let's see, about 20 units installed in various locations in Europe, none installed in the United States. But we do have experience from oil and gas, where oil and gas floating structures,
right,
like these units, will use about 3 mooring lines. Those use 6 to 8 mooring lines. And so they're actually closer to each other. And like I said, nobody knows of any entanglement that happened on any of the floating structures so far.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you for your presentation. I appreciate that. I was wondering, because I've read up about different types of wind energy, and I've read a lot about birds being, killed by them. So out there, 20 miles out, do you know how many or who it will affect bird-wise?
There are a lot less birds far offshore than what you see onshore. And the reason is food. You know, most of the birds onshore, they are, as one of the, scientists kind of said, the land birds are not as smart as their relatives offshore. And the reason is because the offshore birds, they have to navigate themselves by the air pressure, because that's what they have to do, and their food is on the bottom of the, or on the surface of the ocean. So they fly fairly low. And also they sense the change in pressure. When the wind turbine spins, it creates a disturbance. Like, birds don't fly into the thunderstorms, right? Because it's a different pressure, so they avoid it. And effect is kind of the same. They try to avoid the wind farm completely. They just fly around it. Where the shorebirds don't do that because they don't navigate the same way. They navigate by other methods, and most of it is actually food, which is, you know, on the trees or on the bottom or whatever. And so they used to fly into the turbines, but it also relates to the methods that were used. When the first wind farms were installed, the people trenched the trench to put the cables through. And this open trench attracted a lot of birds and bats, for that matter, because all the insects that they eat were coming to the surface because the trench is open. Now they don't do that anymore. And so if you look at the collision of birds with wind turbines today compared to 25 years ago when the first wind farms were installed, it's significantly reduced. One of them because methodology changed. The other one is because now the wind turbines are spaced a lot further apart. And so the birds actually learned how to avoid them. So though there is no way to prevent any collision, I mean, there's just no thing in the world that doesn't have some impacts. The impacts offshore are a lot less than they are onshore, and that's because the birds are kind of smarter.
Okay, one more question. The photo that you showed of the port that was more or less...
Mm-hmm.
All the wind farm transit
components.
Station, or
yep.
However, that looks pretty big.
It is big.
How much does that particular site generate?
Well, this is the port that supplies wind turbine components for offshore wind installation. This would be fixed installations. I can't tell you how many units they support. But we are analyzing the studies, and we now have dimensions identified what we would need to do fabrication of, let's say, 100 units in 2-year period. So that's another part that Castle Wind, because ENBW is a very disciplined company, we are doing design as we speak, preliminary design, that will answer all these questions. What is the exact space area that we need? Where can we do that? What? And we're almost coming to the point where we need to look for floating capabilities because we can't find shore locations that are big enough to do what needs to be done. I don't have all the answers yet because we are just starting all this work, but we're doing it. Because we need to know where what we're going to do and how much it's going to cost and whether the wind farm is going to be financially viable.
One more question on that. When they're taking the energy from the wind turbines and then putting it into the grid, is that something that could possibly cause pollution, either air or sound or any kind of negative effects in that process?
Well, any wind turbine is going to create turbulence around it, but that's, you know, you take any wind turbine, it doesn't really matter whether it's offshore or onshore. The floating support structures eliminate any vibration because they're floating, and so you don't have vibration like the fixed foundations do have. When you put the underwater cable, which is what you have, there are so many cables around the world that it's not new technology whatsoever. All of the cables are insulated, and so you don't really have emissions from the cables themselves. So if you look onshore, you know, you have power lines, right? We effectively do the same thing. We just put it in the bottom of the ocean floor. But the cables are bigger because there is a lot more protection, and that's required. And so because of that, the emissions are a lot lower. There will always be some emissions, but really insignificant. And if you look in Europe, how many cables they're already installed on the bottom of the ocean floor, it's quite a lot. I mean, comparison-wise, there is no comparison, literally. There is almost 20 gigawatts of offshore wind installed just in the North Sea, and all of it has cables going back to shore. So, you know, things work.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Does staff have any questions? Sorry.
Yeah, a couple questions. So we're going to be 1,000 feet deep, 1,000 meters deep. How are the floating structures anchored to the bottom?
They're anchored with anchors, literally. Anchors, very large anchors. Let me see if I still have a picture here. Nope, I don't have the picture. Sorry.
So
I used to have a picture. It's just a very large anchor. There are different types of anchors. There is so-called near vertical launch anchors, there's vertical launch anchors, there's torpedo anchors, there's gravity anchors. It all depends on the type of soil that will be present in the area. But these are identical anchors to what's used in the oil and gas industry.
So the other floating structures around the world are much shallower water.
They're in about 100 meter water depth.
Right, so we're 10 times that deep.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see any problems in that aspect?
No, not at all, because, again, our predecessor and most of the technology that we're using came from oil and gas industry, and those structures sit in 3 to 4,000 meter water depth.
Okay,
and so we don't see that we're going to run into any issues because we're not creating that technology. We're basically reusing what's already exist.
So my next question is, we're going to be somewhere 30 miles away from the shoreline. Will there be any substations on these cables? Or
right, there will be a substation offshore, also floating, because you need to collect energy from all the turbines to one point and then just bring one or maybe two for redundancy purpose cables back to shore. So, yes, there will be floating offshore substations as well.
And so once electricity comes to shore, and we're going to assume Morro Bay here,
mm-hmm.
What kind of infrastructure is going to be needed here to bring the power up to the grid?
Well, actually, the infrastructure already exists, and we would like to use what there is. As I showed you at the beginning, the outflow tunnel that was there from the plant gives a perfect infrastructure repurposing because we can bring the cable. So here's the cable coming from offshore. It will go into the tunnel, and it can come to the old unit number 4 turbine, which is the closest to the substation. So the only thing, what's known as a genti or connection into the substation, will be about 200 feet.
Okay.
And you can do that underground or overhead.
So my next question is, how much support vessels are going to be needed for the structures, for the system?
I'd rather answer that question after our O&M people come here next week, and they will be talking to Eric quite a bit. So I think we'll be able to define things a lot better as we go through the design. I can't really answer that right now. But one thing they will be looking is, because the infrastructure is 30 miles offshore, some of the methodologies to support that includes support personnel vessels that are big enough to stay offshore for about a week. And then they bring people back and forth to that support vessel. So that's one of the questions that they have, why they need to look at the infrastructure, is where could I come with that vessel? You know, it's a big catamaran, and can I come here or can I come there? And we don't know the answers yet. We just know what's needed. And so that's why this trip is very important, and I'm very grateful to Eric to provide support and talk to the people. But out of that will come out, here's what's needed, here's what's possible here or there based on the physical infrastructure constraints.
Thank you.
Does staff have any questions?
Oh, sorry, Lynn?
Yes, just to repeat, did you say only 3 gigawatts would fit in that area that you delineated?
Yes.
So all of this, okay, thank you.
However, again, I don't know what we'll end up with. It kind of depends on where Department of Defense is. So at least looking at 400 square miles, that's maximum you can probably do is going to be 3 gigawatts, assuming that there is no major obstacles on the bottom of the ocean floor, like a big rock formation or something where you cannot put the anchors. If you can utilize every inch of that space, literally, you may be able to squeeze 4. But at this point, I wouldn't even say that.
Any other board questions? Does staff have any questions?
I was just going to ask Ala to expand a little bit, but I think she answered most of it with Jean's question about the boats. And I know it's all very early and preliminary, and you're still trying to figure all this out, but the city of Morbay is very interested in, obviously the things can't be built here unless we, you know, spend billions of dollars expanding this harbor, which will never happen. And it's just too small of a harbor for that to happen in. We're hoping that Castle, assuming they win the bid and build these things, puts the maximum amount of activity into our harbor and in our town. And I was going to ask you to expand a little bit on that. Knowing it may not be here, it may be somewhere else, and some may have to be ports on those, who knows, you're still trying to figure all that out. But what is the potential? What may we be looking at in terms of activity?
We would like to put a monitoring center here and have all our O&M activity coming from here. That's why this trip next week is so important, to see what size of vessels can come into the Morro Bay Harbor. It also means that we need access to the infrastructure already here. And in particular, there is a pump house over here. That becomes very important because you need to be able to bring vessels somewhere. Let's assume that the vessels are possible to come and we can put our infrastructure here. Two main questions are, what is the size of the vessels we can bring? Where can they dock? And where can we put communications equipment? Because we need line of sight to the installation, and so that's a fairly high site. And you can see that the towers that are here, actually they're quite well suited for providing this communications infrastructure, but city doesn't own the plant. You know, another company owns the plant, so it will have to be somewhat negotiated until, you know, once we define what's possible. So after next week's trip, we will know what can and cannot be done, and then we'll probably talk to the city again and say, here's what we can and cannot do based on the physical constraints. Here's the things that could be improved. Here's the things that cannot be improved for whatever reasons, and then we'll figure out the plan how to proceed. But we've got to figure out the assessment. We've got to do the assessment first, which is what's happening. In addition to just looking at the infrastructure, people are meeting with the Slow Labor, I think, board or something to find out, you know, what are the labor rates in the area, you know, because we're looking at how many people need to be hired and who and what job categories exist and don't exist. So all of that is a big, you know, is a part of this whole assessment that is taking place now.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time and the effort you've gone through.
Thank you.
Moving on with our traditional agenda items, we do not have the chairman for the Boat Marine Services Facilities, so we're going to bypass item B1 today unless there's any comment or questions. All right. Moving on, item B2, update from the Finance and Budget Ad Hoc Committee. Eric, do you want to start us off there?
Sure. So this is some of our ongoing budget and finance efforts with the committee and into the budget year. As you know, we're well underway in our budgeting. I think the budget is slated to be approved at the June 11th City Council meeting. Our current budget, so I'm presenting this one to continue to educate the public on the Harbor Fund budget, which is can be a little mysterious to some because it's not part of the general fund and we generally don't get a lot of attention. So we're trying to make sure the public's well aware of our budget and our capital planning and our capital projects. So I just wanted to bring this to the light once again. Our budget this year for the next fiscal year, 19-20, is balanced. It's about a $2.2 million budget. We've got enough revenues to cover our expenses, but not by very much. As we know, we've been talking recently over the last couple of years about trying to figure out how to get more revenues over expenses because we have a huge backlog of capital issues to deal with. So while we're balanced, we're not balanced by very much, and we're not putting very much in the piggy bank to take care of the future. So the council has done a fair amount of budgeting study sessions and whatnot to date so far. We've had budget forecast sessions. We've had budget study sessions, three of those. Put on by Jennifer Calloway in the finance department, done a great job with all that, and then put together our budgets. We've had goal setting planning as well that feeds into the budget. So, again, the budget's slated to be approved on June 11th. So our operating budget, again, is just over $2 million of revenues, about $1.99 in expenses, again, for net annual revenue of about $20,000 on the plus side. The budget forecast tool that we use that we hired management partners to develop several years ago that you may or may not remember, it's probably about the most convoluted and complicated and astounding Excel program I've ever seen. It's got pages that feed into pages that have all sorts of complicated formulas that ends up spitting these numbers out in the end. It's a pretty amazing tool. But anyhow, that tool looks at CPI factors and inflationary factors and economic factors that I don't pretend to understand, but ends up coming up with what they think the budget will do over a series of years. And the 10-year forecast predicts a deficit in next fiscal year for our budget of about $13,000 and then net annual surpluses in 21, 22, and beyond. The biggest change is going to be in fiscal year 2021, which is the last year that our South T Pier loan payments are due. That's about $135,000 per year. So that is our biggest relief on the horizon in terms of our budget and what we may see with some extra revenues over expenses. So over the longer term, over that 8 to 10 year arrangement or forecast, the budget model predicts about a hundred and some odd $1,000 surplus every year going out about 10 years with a net annual gain of about $1 million through 2028-29, which sounds great on the surface, but $1 million will not do a heck of a lot of work. So while it's good that we're gaining on our budget, we're not gaining fast enough because we have at least for 5 years out, we've got about $875,000 worth of backlog that if we had a checkbook that had no balance restrictions in it right now, we could easily spend $800,000 plus a year on just trying to catch up on all the capital needs we have now.
Does that also include the rainy day fund that we were looking at as setting aside the 15% of the budget?
No.
So that $875 does not include that additional
goal. That is
goal.
Just the capital needs, the money we need to spend on stuff, piers, slips, boats, all the other stuff, all the big ticket items. No, it doesn't account for that money that the council last year put together for the reserve fund minimum. So, no, that's not putting any of that. We might be able to do that without spending anything on capital with the gains we'll make over 10 years, but we need to make some gains on capital. So short of cutting some services or a major departmental reorganization, we've done just about everything we can to streamline our operations. I think we're pretty darn thrifty and do a heck of a lot with not very much money. As you know, our administrative technician, Charlie, moved on up to the recreation department late last year, and we didn't rehire that position, so now we're all doing even more. We've saved money with that. We're still, that's not enough to put away for the big ticket capital stuff. Of existing revenues, the lease policy update group has been working a lot on fair market value the last couple meetings, the last few months. While we're not quite done with our work, we think we've gone far enough to make the statement that for the most part, our leases are in the right ballpark for fair market values. We're not way high, we're not way low in comparison to others up and down the coast. So, and even if we were way out, we've got so many leases in place now that are from 20 to 50 years, it would take a long time for that to cumulatively take effect. It could over time, but there really isn't a big discrepancy there, so we don't see anything happening there in the long or short term. The city's master fee study is nearing completion. We met with the primary fellow that's doing that this week. Some of our fees, it's a work in progress, and we're still feeding data into it. It appears that some of our fees may be below cost recovery levels and or below market levels. The city's general fund fees, like for recreation services, when junior lifeguard program, we'll use that as an example. A city can't charge a fee going into a general fund that's more than the cost to provide whatever it is they're providing. Enterprise funds can, because we need to put money in the bank for doing other stuff, so we're able to charge market rates. So the fee study's looking at all those, and it appears that some of the things are below market or full cost recovery, but it's still in development. The city council is, in fact, I think the last meeting they approved last year's, the existing master fee schedule is going to stay in place until probably August or September when this study is done, and then we'll be bringing that forward to council. So depending on where the rates end up with the fee study and then what council ends up wanting to do with them, we'll see if we get any kind of recovery out of that. Capital projects, as you know, in the existing budget, I've got $250,000 in my launch ramp grant from Boating and Waterways. That's not, doesn't have any direct effect other than my time and staff's time on our budget, but that's not a direct effect on our accumulation fund. What we are putting in for from the accumulation fund is about $42,000 for some South T-Pair work that needs to get done, about $10,000 for North T-Pair work that gets done, about $20,000 for the ice machine, I'm hoping, knock on wood, to need less than that with all the work we just did on the machine with having all the refrigeration system replaced, but we'll see. Still a little, I've got post-ice stress syndrome over that with that machine. The last few years we've spent a lot of money, so I'm not assuming anything at this point. And about $370,000 for our Beach Street slips replacement, that project I'm trying to move forward and just having trouble dedicating time to it because it's taken a fair amount of time. So those are big ticket items, and if we spend all that this year, our accumulation fund will be down to about four figures.
Is that four figures with or without decimal points?
Without. So less than $10,000. Don't know how this year is going to end. I was fairly gloomy a month or two ago on looking at our revenues and how we were doing, especially on some of our slip and pier rates. But as Jeremiah said earlier, we don't know what to do with all the salmon boats right now, and most of them are taking slips or pier space. So those revenues are hopefully going to get back up at least where I predicted they would go. Looking like we were going to come in low, so I'm hopeful that if they do come in, we'll put a little bit of money in the bank this year, but we'll see how it goes. Just hope for the fish stick around. And then potential new revenue sources, as Councilman Davis said earlier, the council is really focused on our infrastructure needs and putting some major focus on funding sources, revenue sources, to help get some money in the bank for us. And really their number one goal from an economic standpoint is not just general fund, but Harbor Fund as well, is developing potential new revenue sources. At the May 28th council meeting, they considered several revenue-generating options that the finance department brought forward. One of them was RV camping at various places on the waterfront. One was paid parking, and another was assessment districts. Of these, the council direction was to not pursue any kind of RV parking or camping on the waterfront at this time, but they directed staff to research and bring back analysis on paid parking and assessment districts. From a paid parking standpoint, as you know, the HAB looked at that last year. In fact, there's even now, it's 2017. We didn't research the issues and bring answers or recommendations forward. We just brought primarily a list of here's the issues you need to consider if we're going to look at paid parking on and around the Embarcadero. We did recommend pursuing a paid parking program, but we said here's the issues. So we'll probably start with that. Staff has yet to get together at an executive level and really figure out what the next steps on that are. But tonight, and we'll end up circling back to this, we're going to seek Harbor Advisory Board. If there's any other recommendations on that memo, I did include that in the back of the staff report, the memo that we provided to the Planning Commission regarding paid parking. So if we want to look at that at some point, we can look and see if there's any other recommendations or any other input we want to have on paid parking. And then assessment districts, the City Council was interested in potentially pursuing that. As you know, I think Dana McClish brought forward a couple of years ago the notion of a harbor district, the harbor special district, to potentially fund the harbor department, especially the infrastructure. Under the Harbors and Navigation Code, which is the state set of state laws that really dictates how harbors operate and all the boating regulation and facility stuff, there are harbors and port districts that can be formed. Port San Luis is a harbor district. Santa Cruz is a port district. Ventura is a port district. It's a special district made under Harbors and Nav Code that has a potential to be formed. And there's other districts that could be formed as well. There's business districts that could be formed. There's multiple districts. I gave you a handout that Ron had put together with some funding options. There's a bunch of taxing information on there, and then there's other district information on there. It's really just for informational purposes, not really a decision-making thing like, yes, let's pursue that, yes, let's pursue this. It's just an informational item. So council said to go forward with it. So, again, we'll be looking at executive level how we're going to pursue this and see what may be possible. And special districts are basically would be an assessment on a property tax on the parcels that would be deemed to be receiving a special benefit from whatever the district is. Port San Luis, is, for example, includes all of, most of San Luis Obispo, about the southern half of San Luis Obispo, and all of South County. That was put together in the 1950s and basically says of all these people living within this district, they're gaining a special benefit from the harbor. And that argument could, I think, easily be applied to Morro Bay. It's just what would the district be and under what sort of stipulations would it be formed under, who would govern it. A lot of rabbit holes to go down, but a potential long-term solution for some of our revenue problems. And then, again, any other revenue-generating ideas, as you heard from Councilman Davis tonight, I think sort of a statement, let's start throwing spaghetti on the wall and see what sticks. If there's any other ideas we want to try and move forward, I don't think anything's off the board. Bringing forward a comprehensive set of revenue enhancement options for City Council consideration is what the City Council wants to see. So those are the things we want to discuss tonight and see if the Harbor Advisory Board has any other input. And then also attached to your staff report is my latest capital spreadsheets. I apologize, they printed portrait instead of landscape because you need a microscope to read them. But those are my most updated 5-year capital projections. Again, I always sort of call these the if money was no object, this is where we would budget things. Unfortunately, I don't have all this money budgeted because we don't have this money to budget, but that's how things plan out. If you look at the life of our various facilities and major equipment and then amortize it over a number of years when it should be replaced, those are the numbers that fall out of those spreadsheets.
Thank you. And Ron asked me to bring up the fact that the Division of Boating and Waterways also is a possibility for long-term loans that may be able to be used for this. And then, therefore, the revenue impact would be less, but over a longer period of time. That may be something worth researching.
Yeah, so it's a good point. Boating and Waterways has a loan program in addition to all the grant programs, but they have loan programs. And good number of harbors have availed themselves to them, including ours. That's where our South Tea Pier loan came from. That was $200,000, or $2 million, sorry. I think it was a 20-year loan. And the payments, again, about $135,000 a year. So, yeah, that is a potential funding source. And, you know, like anything, you need to build something. Most people don't build houses or buy houses without getting a loan because they don't have that much money in their pocket. So that is a potential avenue to pursue. And Boating Waterways, their interest rate is legislatively set. I think it's been set for decades at the same number. It doesn't change. It doesn't fluctuate up and down with anything. It's a legislatively set number, and it's fairly reasonable. I want to say it's you know, 3 to 4% range, maybe.
Yeah. Well, obviously, the choices for us in terms of where we can obtain additional funds are from where we have assets in which to put forth, such as for parking. You know, anything that was charged in terms of parking on the trust property would be revenue would be heading for the trust, would it not?
It would, absolutely, and generated on trust property. Determine exactly which side of the line the different things would be on. I personally would argue that, you know, revenue generated on the other side, people, and I guess it could be argued both ways. Somebody might park on one side of the road versus the other. You can't necessarily say that they're using the trust. You know, they've parked and used the trust meter, and they're parking in the trust, or they're going to go shop in the trust business. It could be a mix and match. So I don't know if there's any way that you would even try to determine that or split it up in that sort of way. I would probably just assume that whatever's on one side goes to one side, and whatever's on the other side goes to the other side. Mm-hmm. They've definitely got more. If you start looking at the feeder streets, more potential space to put more revenue generators.
Well, very similar to what we were talking today with regard to the wind farm and the option that they've paid for to cross the Tidelands Trust lands as well, and those funds.
Yeah, and the wind farm. So, yes, Castle Wind did pay $250,000 to the city for the right to lease the outfall. That outfall lease, if it comes to be, hopefully it does, there would obviously be some sort of payment included with that, and that would entirely be harbor fund revenues, just like the old lease was with the power plant.
So, therefore, so should the option money?
Yeah, well, council hasn't decided what to do with that yet.
I understand.
Sitting in the bank right now. Yeah. So from a paid parking standpoint, like I said, the memo that we put to the Planning Commission is in here. I don't know if the HAB has any further input or discussion they want to do on the paid parking front. Like I said, we as staff haven't at the executive level figured out, you know, how we're going to move forward with this and how we're going to evaluate it and bring information back to council. I'm sure at some point we'll be bringing decision-making, recommendation-type stuff back to the HAB for input, but we're definitely not there yet. We're just starting out.
I think it's probably better. Are there any questions with regard to parking currently?
Yeah, we've been looking at paid parking for a number of years, and initially, if I remember right, it was not a big money maker because we were going to have to hire somebody to take the money in and account it and stuff like that. But things have probably changed a little bit. So it may be a way of generating some revenue. I'm just curious, the parking lot on the east side of the Embarcadero, I think probably it's a good idea to try to see if we can't acquire that funding from there. So down below the buff, the free parking area now.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, if you really carry it forward and, you know, and look at some of the things we've looked at as a city, some of the visioning things like the promenade from the former city manager, which I don't think is a bad idea to get rid of the parking on the west side of the road to open that up and make it more pedestrian-friendly and user-friendly. well, that just eliminates all our potential to generate revenue for paid parking. So my argument would be, well, I don't have any revenue generating capacity. They're all parking over here and paying you to use my land, use Harbor Trust Fund land. That doesn't seem right. So anyhow, that stuff could all be worked out. Paid parking typically, unless you own, and I'm no paid parking expert, but unless you've got some pretty big lots, paid parking isn't a big nugget of gold to potentially go find. It's used for two purposes. One, to generate some revenue, because yes, there are costs to manage it. You know, obviously you got to have folks, you know, police it. You can't just put in paid parking and never enforce it. Otherwise, people catch on after a while and stop paying. So there's a definite cost to put it in and maintain it. I think the costs have gone down over the years in that the technology, you know, things have gone wireless and you know, it's not going and collecting the quarters like it used to anymore. I think it's become cheaper, but there's still a fair amount of cost to it. So it's not a huge revenue maker unless you've got a lot of space. But what the second part that paid parking is used for is for parking management. It's to keep the employees from parking on where you don't want them to park. It's to get turnover, get people moving through, and that sort of thing. So it's a tool to be used for several things. But yes, I think probably one of our first efforts from a staff standpoint is going to be engaging some of the outfits that do this for a living and trying to figure out, having them look at it and see what the cost revenue benefit ratios are. Absolutely.
On a side note, I see that our triangle lot is getting a lot more boats in there. That's good to see. So.
Yeah, we have. I think the fencing is giving people, and the season, it's summer too. And when did we put it in? We put it in kind of what? Middle of winter or early spring. We've getting more and more, and they've got a couple sailboats up there, and we put in the temporary fencing, so if we needed to, we could expand out and get some more space, but yeah, it's starting to look pretty good finally.
Any other further comment or questions?
Can we make any suggestions towards the parking issue to think about? May I?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because I looked into it a lot. It's something that's near and dear to my heart that I've gone to, like, workshops, and, like, it's on the daily an issue for us down that work on the Embarcadero. But some of the things that people have brought up that I particularly am fond of going forward with is to try and use that D'Estacio's lower parking lot as a trial run of what it would be like to have paid parking down there, the reception that we would get from customers and employees and employers. There's one particular one that I've been looking at for like 3 years since Cal Poly put it in play. It's called Park Mobile. They have 324 coin-operated meters, and they are actually, you can use an app. And so if you feel like I'm going to miss out and you have to go and put some coins in there, you can actually just auto-pay it. There is an element of paid parking that is really annoying to people who come and visit places, and that's that they're always thinking, like, oh, is my meter? Oh, you know, and it just kills the relaxation point of visiting a place, that if you feel like you're just going to get a $90 ticket or something to go there, you're like, forget it, I'm not even going to try. But with that one, it was just so easy, it was really efficient, and it just put a lot of pieces. You can even on the app set it that if you're close to it, it sends you a little thing, you just push one button and bam, you're taken care of.
That only works if you have a smartphone.
That is true. So you can go back and use the quarters. So it's not one or the other, it's both. So the people... yeah. And then the second thing that has been brought up is the triangle lot as far as it being a potential for free parking. I would really like to see something more like free full-day parking. I mean, even if it just alluded to like full-day parking, it would get a lot of the people who are parking there at 6 a.m. and staying the whole entire day and taking up those spaces that so are are needed so much for the people that are only going to be there an hour to 2 hours, so we can get some turnaround instead of people actually literally turning around and not going to those destinations. And then thirdly is, and I'll talk about it a little bit more in the lease policy, and that's a letter to all the people who have leases on the Embarcadero, and just once again reminding them, hey, if you want business, if people to come to your business, park somewhere farther than right there in front of your business. I have people who they park right in front of their own business. I'm like, do you not get it that you're actually reducing the fact of a customer coming to your place? And if we could just remind them in a nice, courteous letter without me being the parking meter, not, you know, mean person. So anyway, those are my suggestions for us to think about in future.
Thank you. Any other comment or anything with regard to item B2, the Finance and Budget Committee?
I just have a brief question about having put the kiosk in for the trailered parking down in at Tidelands. How much is the revenue from that now that it's been paid for?
So the cost for that system was about $15,000 to put it on place. There's an annual subscription fee of, I want to say, about $1,000 maybe. Plus phone, because it's remote, it's solar, so there's a phone, you know, there's a phone system in that to communicate to the world. But the revenues generated out of that are about $30,000. Yeah.
Not much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right, moving on to Eelgrass and the Eelgrass Ad Hoc Committee.
We have not met. We're still sort of plodding along, talking to Anchor QEA. I have nothing new to report.
Anybody have any questions? Item B4, the update on the Harbor Department Lease Management Policy Update Process.
Okay, so that's me. Okay, so the last lease policy update group, we met and we talked about a lot of what Eric said about fair market value, and we received totals, and the lease held, we looked in at different lease held government properties up and down the coast and even in other areas. We are continuing to compile data for a table that will be available to staff, HAB, council, and public based on like what the percentages are, what the base rents are up and down the coast of California, so we can see where we lie in that. It'll be easier to see where we fit in and what would be considered fair, and also separates what a ground lease is compared to a building lease and where we lie in that. For our next meeting, we have been working on and we'll be discussing items such as lease terms, lease extensions, lease maintenance, and different auditing procedures. And I would like to speak on the two issues we are currently working on that the viewing public might find important. A couple of us on the lease management group walked the Embarcadero with a clipboard last Tuesday morning. I'd like to call on the leaseholders down there to put their best face on for their business for this summer. We saw lots of exterior walkways cased with black grease from kitchen areas to trash areas to entryways. All the kids are getting out of the schools, and it will be getting busier, so now is the time to go thoroughly clean the facades of our businesses, because in a little while we won't even be able to, like, water your plants. There will be so many people walking up and down the street. Most importantly is the current crucial issue, which is the parking, which, again, I wanted to just say that with paid parking on everyone's mind, I would like to give the leaseholders the opportunity to ease the problem by requesting all their employees to park a block or so up from the Embarcadero. or provide, and something that was kind of cool that I've learned about a lot of different places, Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, Santa Cruz, is some of the employers give compensation to the employees who use public transit or ride their bike to school, which could be something that we find remedies or at least aids in our parking issue. That's it.
Questions? Do we have any idea when we would be seeing some written output from the subcommittee?
I'll let Eric handle that one.
You can see the gears turning. There's smoke coming out of my ears.
The drum roll.
I'm not sure where I'm hopeful the August or September meeting. I'm trying to get to the critical mass point that makes some sense to bring to the HAB. The groups, mostly the folks, have been individually and collectively working, sometimes in groups, sometimes individually, mostly just doing homework and getting us data and feeding us stuff. Need to get all that into draft form and bring it through the group and then bring it to the Harbor Advisory Board. So we don't have a meeting in July unless I don't put any suggestions anybody had, but you know, we've canceled we don't have the July meeting because it's on the 4th. So unless we do a special meeting, our next meeting after this will be August. So hopeful some August, September. The plan, at least according to this, what we brought to the City Council was to, you know, have this done sometime by early summer. Once we got into the process, it became clear that it's going to take time, even though we've got a good number of people on the group. It takes time to put this stuff together, and staff time's limited, and I pretty much made the executive decision. I'm not going to rush it. We'll get it done at the pace that it needs to get done to do it right, because we want to do it right and not just do something because we've got an artificial timeline. So,
well, I don't think the board would be opposed to seeing a draft, even in a draft form. Yeah. You know, so
I'll try for August. I'll try and get something in August.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Any other questions, comments, anything from any of the board members? I will entertain a motion.
I'll make that motion that we adjourn.
I'll second that motion.
What about future agenda items?
I'm sorry. Does anybody have future agenda items?
I don't. I
just
part of
the world.
I believe you.
Oh, he did.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Our next meeting, regular meeting, will be August, as the meeting would normally fall on July 4th. And I have better things to do, as I'm sure everybody here does. And declaration of future agenda items. I would propose that we eliminate from the review of. For primitive camping as a revenue source from future agenda items at this point. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none opposed? Carries. I will now entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion that we adjourn.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We stand adjourned.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
I got my chicken.
Still get my Jeopardy game.